Oh yeah, that's worse. All right, good morning. As we get started today, I just wanted to give you a little bit of a roadmap, sort of, for where we're headed in the weeks ahead as far as Sunday sermons go. I will conclude or finish the book of Titus this morning, but next Sunday I intend to do kind of a recap of some of the important points of application from the letter. We've been studying it for about 12 weeks, and there were some really, the idea here as we went through Titus was this is a kind of a blueprint for a healthy church, and I think there's some things that we can, some high points we can hit one more time. So I'm going to do a recap of Titus next week. That will be October the 14th, and remember, that is a 9 o'clock service only. It's Pastor Appreciation Sunday, and so we're going to have one service, unified service, at 9 o'clock, and then a reception in the foyer immediately after that with no Sunday school or second service. That's next week. Pastor Carl will actually be preaching on October the 21st, and then October the 28th is Reformation Sunday, and so we will have a Reformation-themed message that day. On November 4th, lots of things happening, by the way. On November 4th, we will be hearing from a retiring missionary, Randy Fudge. Randy and Carolyn have served for, I don't know, more than 20 years in Africa and then in Ireland, and they are retiring. This is their home now from the field, and they will not return again. So Randy and Carolyn will be here, and so we're going to do the same sort of thing for them, a single service. Randy's actually going to preach for us. I don't know that any of you have really probably heard Randy. He hasn't preached the last couple of times he's been here. But Randy will preach for us, and then we'll... during the Sunday school hour, they'll kind of share a recap of all that God has accomplished through their ministry over the last 20-some years, and then we'll have a short reception for them following that in the fellowship hall and no second service. And then we finish up November with, we'll probably just have kind of a three-part topical series, because then it's Advent. And I don't want to start a new book of the Bible and then take a break for Advent and pick it up in January. So I'll give you maybe a three-part topical sermon series, and then it's Christmas, which is a good thing. All right. Believe it or not. But today, we still have some work to do in these closing verses of Titus. So let's take a look there. Now, it was read to you already. I won't read it again. But we're towards the end of this letter. Paul is wrapping up like he typically does his letters. He's going to give a couple of more exhortations, a couple of more commands, some more instruction, and then he's going to wrap up with some greetings and some instructions about how to handle his team of men who are going ahead of him and coming behind him, and he's trading out players and putting them in other places, and he wants to let everybody know what's going on. So in this last part, he's going to give Titus a couple of instructions. He's going to give Titus some things that he expects him to affirm, to strengthen, to push on, to lean into, and some things, again, for Titus to avoid. And these are written specifically to Titus, but they're applicable to church leaders today. And in fact, I think you'll see as we go on, beneficial for Christians in general, who are serving the Lord in any kind of local context. The things that he tells Titus he wants to affirm are things that he describes as profitable, valuable, and good. And the things that he is to avoid are the opposite. They are unprofitable and useless. So let's see what those things are. Let's start by looking at what Paul believes would be profitable for Titus. And he brings up again this subject of good works. He tells Titus to make sure that he insists that people who are Christ followers are careful to devote themselves to good works. Some of your English translations will say maintain good works. This is a repeated theme in the book of Titus. If I can remind you, he says that from Titus 3, he says, what we just read, the good works in 3:14 and 3:8, be ready for every good work in Titus 3:1, be zealous for good works in Titus 2:14, have a pattern of good works, Titus 2:7, and he says here that in chapter 1, when he was talking about the false teachers, he says they are disqualified for every good work. And so there is Paul is placing some serious value on the people of God being known as a people of good works. And I think that's something that we've lost a bit in our context today. It would be great for the church, even if people in a community thought they've got some pretty wacky ideas over there, but man, they're helpful. Man, they're kind. I just love the good that they do. I love seeing all of these. So we're going to cut them a little slack on their wackiness because they serve our community well. That's a recurring theme here in the book of Titus. But it's important because here some Christians swing from one extreme to the other, as we typically do in our pendulum of trying to figure out how to live like Jesus. We cannot, in doing good works, ever misunderstand the purpose of doing good works or the point. They are not done. They are not the gospel. Good works, justice, is not the gospel. We don't buy or earn our way into heaven by doing these things. We don't buy or earn favor with God in any way by doing these good works. God saves us by grace, not by our works. That's clear in multiple passages. We went back to Titus 2 before, and in last week in Titus 3, it was there too. But as Paul reminds us in the book of Ephesians, we were created to do these good works. That now that we have been saved, now that our hearts have been made new, they are now capable of doing the good works that we were made to do. And so we are to do them, Paul says, Peter says, Jesus says in the Gospel of Matthew, we do our good works that God is glorified. We do our good works in the community not for our own benefit, not so people can say, man, that guy is a nice guy. We do our good works so they can look at us and say that the God that we serve is a great God. So whenever we're doing these good works, it must always be in the context of pushing the credit and the value of good works back onto our Creator. And I have found, we have seen, that good works are a good way to help open doors to communicating the gospel, to prepare us a place, to create a space for us in which we gain a hearing of the gospel. Most of the missionary church is a strong denomination with a strong missionary emphasis, obviously. It's in the name of the denomination. But when our family served in Haiti, I remember learning kind of firsthand what this looked like, as we had all of these missionaries who were part of our staff down in Haiti, but some were farmers, some were mechanics, some were nurses and other medical personnel. And they did, like, when you looked, it was hard to tell, but they were there in the country doing all these works of service. But every one of those works of service was an opportunity to share the gospel and to plant churches. That's how they used those good works in order to spread the gospel message. So we have to be careful not to stop with all the good works we're doing and never put the emphasis on God and the gospel as to why we're doing it. But we also must be careful not to think that we're just going to be heard if we don't get out there and love our community and do good things. I think good works also help us. When we are exercising these good works, they are a demonstration to us that we do in fact have a living faith and not the dead faith that James describes that has no works. Good works are also they're going to be necessary if you want to be like Jesus. And then what we just said here in Titus 3:8, sometimes we do good works just because they're the right thing to do. They're good and they're valuable and they help people. There's a couple of kinds of good works I think that it's important to mention here. There are, of course, good works that are totally spiritual in nature. When you share with others about your faith and when you tell others the good news about God's grace, is there anything better that you could do for them than that? Of course not. That's why our good works are coupled with the good work of evangelism. It's also a way that we encourage one another. There's nothing like doing good works for those who are part of the household of faith. When they're suffering, when they're hurting, when they've experienced loss, and the body of Christ rallies around them and provides for their needs, a tremendous source of encouragement. And it also can be a way that weak brothers and sisters in Christ, their faith is strengthened when they see God meeting their needs through you, through us. But of course, there's good works that are physical in nature, those are going to vary based on you. They're going to vary based on you, your opportunities, your giftedness, your resources, how you can serve, the position in life that you're in. And the Bible gives us plenty of descriptions. We don't need to go through the whole list of good things that you can do. The question is to ask, am I being faithful at doing good works? Am I being faithful in, on the spiritual side of things, sharing my faith, sharing the gospel, sharing the good news of God's grace, and am I meeting physical needs of people as well in the church and out of the church? So Paul is telling Titus, insist on these things. Insist that the people of God are constantly learning how to keep doing good works. It's that verb tense that means this isn't something that we have one Sunday a week where it's good work Sunday. This is something that we are to be maintaining as a regular part of our walk with Christ. But he now tells him, the apostle now tells Titus, that there are certain things he needs to avoid. And in this case, it's even like people. There's certain people that need to be avoided. There's four things really here. There's foolish controversies, genealogies, arguments, quarrels about the law, and the people that refuse to stop arguing about these things. Now, before we jump into this section, it's important to note that Paul is not saying that we can't have theological controversy. We are going to have theological controversy. There are going to be things that we disagree on. There are going to be things that we disagree on that are very serious. There are going to be things that we disagree on that are, not so serious. But we are going to have disagreements, and that's okay. We need to have that. We need to have that. But what Paul is banning here are foolish controversies. It could be translated speculations. These are things that people want to focus on that they don't really have any evidence or ability to prove, but they just want to argue about something. I know you don't know anybody like that, but I know a few. And it seems from the context that, once again, most of this centers around some Jewish questions. Maybe the Judaizers or others have begun arguing. He talks about quarrels about the law. He talks about genealogies in that particular case. So it's probably a Jewish debate that's in view. If you want more details, for whatever reason, when Paul wrote to Timothy, he expanded a little bit more on this. He gives us some more details in 1 Timothy chapter 1, verses 3 to 11. Paul says that the false teachers there are devoting themselves to myths and endless genealogies, that they want to be teachers of the law. Paul sees the arguments of this nature to be entirely frivolous. Their speculation, the arguments don't do anything good. They only create what we see in the text here in the ESV, arguments and quarrels. Older English translations say quibbles and squabbles. That's why I put that for the title of the sermon, because I just love that phrase. If you want to talk about this and argue about this, the only thing that it produces in the church are quibbles and squabbles. Could we be guilty? We have to ask the question, is this something that we have to watch out for? If not specifically genealogies and debates about the law, but are there things that we run the risk of making into something like this, something that's a quibble and a squabble and not real? I don't have a lot of time today. It's Communion Sunday, but I did want to take a little bit of time on this. I've been involved in theological discussions and doctrinal issues in numerous settings. Conversations, basic as conversations with friends, in Christian schools, deciding what the basic set of beliefs were going to be as a requirement for the teachers or board members. I've worked with denominational discussions over requirements for licensing and ordaining pastors, what they'll need to believe, and even in a local church, what are we going to require of people to believe in order to say that they're members of our congregation. And one of the things that comes up in the most helpful of those discussions is the idea that we must acknowledge, when we have theological discussions and debates, we have to acknowledge that there really is a hierarchy of importance to theological topics, okay? Levels of importance to various doctrines. Not that none of them are unimportant, but that there are levels of importance and weight that we're going to put on different ones. I like what Al Mohler says on this one. He calls it theological triage. And if you take a trip to a local hospital emergency room or you watch an episode of MASH, a rerun of MASH on television, you will see triage happening in the emergency room or there before surgery. It's an intellectual tool that helps medical professionals determine the severity of a need and who's going to be taken care of first. Not so much here in LaPorte, although from time to time, but if you're in a major city in a major trauma center, emergency rooms can get kind of crazy, right? And somebody has to be armed with the medical expertise to make an immediate determination of medical priority, which patient needs to be rushed into surgery immediately, which patients can wait around for a less urgent examination, and which one can be told to sit there in the corner, give them a Kleenex, and let them wait until all of the real hurting people have been taken care of. It's a tough decision to make. It's not simple. But if the medical professional is making that, get nervous and it slows them down, then real damage can happen to people physically. They have to take responsibility so that those with the most critical needs get the top priority in terms of treatment. And the word triage comes from the French word trier, which means to sort, right? So we need to do the same thing theologically. So in most cases, if you go out on the internet and look this kind of thing up, you'll see that most theologians, pastors, denominational leaders have like a three-tiered system. First tier, second tier, and third tier issues of theology. The most important ones we're going to call first tier. These are the ones that your salvation hinges on. These are the issues that you have to believe in order to call yourself a Christian. They'll vary a little bit whether you're talking about Protestantism or Catholicism or Orthodoxy. So when I use the word Christian, I mean it in the sense that we're Christians in Protestant Christianity. And these are the beliefs that if you deny them or refuse to believe them or don't accept them, you're denying yourself an essential component of the faith. In our particular context here at LaPorte Missionary Church, we've encapsulated those 10 things as our statement of faith. And that's all you need to believe if you want to be a member here. You have to affirm those 10 basic things that we believe are tier one issues, that to deny them will keep you out of heaven. It's things like the deity of Christ. It's like the gospel of salvation by grace through faith alone. It's the authority of the scriptures. It's these types of things. A second tier doctrine is distinguished from first tier because believing Christians, solid Christians, evangelical Protestant Christians can disagree on them. And though that disagreement may create significant boundaries between other Christians, it is not an issue of separating them from the faith. Now, this is the point at which most doctrines, these are the doctrines that divide most congregations from each other in denominations. Okay? These are the things like, for example, I'll just use one that's probably most familiar. Presbyterians and others do infant baptism based on their understanding of the covenant. Baptistic people like us practice a form of baptism that's called believer's baptism, and we expect you to be able to make a profession of faith before we'll baptize you. Evangelical Christians disagree on that issue, and you can see why that would be a hard one to stay together over. If you have a pastor who doesn't believe in baptizing infants and you do, and you go to that church, you know, tough luck for you, right? And so there are some of these that cause disagreement. This is where most of the arguments happen in Christianity. And most people think and say that this is fine. Divide over these things. It's great. We love you. We all agree on the tier one issues, but there's plenty of room in town for both of our ways of thinking, so we can separate on this. And I agree that there are times where that's necessary. I think there's some second-tier issues, however, that we need to be careful not to divide too quickly over. Second-tier issues are some of the things that sometimes, too, churches will use to say, okay, all these first-tier issues you have to agree on to be a part of our church, but if you want to teach or be a pastor here, we're going to add a few more to the list. And that makes sense to a certain extent, but I want to be careful that we recognize the value of maybe not dividing over some of these second-tier issues. Maybe not dividing, maybe having some really healthy conversations about things that are pretty significant theologically, but knowing that we agree on the most important ones. Because I'll tell you what, no matter how hard you try, you're never going to get a congregation where everybody agrees on everything. I mean, I know I have a list of things that I could tell you right now that I believe that are second-tier theological issues that some of you wouldn't let me get out of the building without trying to convince me how wrong I was on that. I know it. I know it. And so I do my best as I share things like that to remember that you know, second-tier issues, I'm not preaching to the choir necessarily. I may be saying things that you disagree with, and that's okay. It's okay for you to be under a pastor that doesn't agree with everything that you believe. You probably know that already, but I wanted to remind you. And then the third-tier issues, these are the ones that, man, nobody should leave a church over. You should not leave a church over some disagreements on third-tier issues. The first one that comes to my mind most clearly in this one is issues of eschatology, okay? Study of the last things, the return of Jesus and stuff like that. As a Christian, if you believe that Jesus is coming back bodily at the end of the age, that should be enough. We should not divide over timing questions about raptures and millennial kingdoms and things like that. Good, fun discussions can be had, but nobody should get hurt. There should never be a punch thrown, an object thrown in these kinds of discussions. What's funny is I see some of the most heated debates on those issues. People are like, I can't believe it. And they want to string me up, but shouldn't be. All right, I got to move on here. We get a little bit of church discipline under that. Paul says, if you've got somebody like that in your church, sit them down and warn them once. Say, hey, we love having theological discussions, but we're not fighting about that here. Okay. And then a month later, the guy's got a small group meeting in his house, and he lets him have it again, and you hear about it. You go to him again, you say, according to Paul, this is strike two. I'm supposed to warn you one more time, brother, this is not the kind of conversation we have. This is not what we fight over. This is not what we divide over. It needs to stop now. And Paul says if he does it a third time, he's gone. He's gone. Now, that's not harsh, because Paul says what he's doing is divisive. It breaks up the unity of a congregation. And it's on an issue that's not important. You better believe if you've got a small group and there's people in your small group that don't believe that Jesus is God the Son, and they come to me and they say, man, our small group leader, our missional community leader says we have to believe that Jesus is the Son of God. You need to warn him not to be divisive. Oh, hold on. That's a first tier issue. I'm going to come to your small group next week and take over if I have to make sure that that message gets through. He's doing what I need him to do, but not for third tier issues. Okay. All right. So to sum this up, Paul's saying that there is profitable stuff and foolish stuff, useless stuff. And it hinges around theology some, but it also hinges around practice in life. And then so to wrap this up here, at the end, if you want to go down, there's some names here, some of which may be familiar to you from reading the scriptures. Artemas is a name that he mentions in verse 12. Artemas is not mentioned anywhere else in the Bible. This is the only reference to Artemas. It tells us in some of the extra biblical stuff we have from the church fathers that he was one of a group of 70 disciples. He ended up the bishop of Lystra. I don't know if that's true or not, but they mention him. So this guy is coming to Titus. Paul's sending Artemas to Titus. But if Artemas can't get there, Tychicus may come instead. He's mentioned four times in the Bible. He's a Christian from Asia. He's actually from what would be modern-day Turkey today. He traveled with Paul during the end of his third journey in Acts chapter 20. We see that he was sent to Ephesus and to the Colossians with information on Paul's welfare. You can read about that. And he was also sent, according to 2 Timothy, near the end of Paul's life, he was sent back to Ephesus. And Colossians says that this guy is a beloved brother, a faithful minister, and a fellow servant of the Lord. So Paul says some good things about him. And as soon as one of them gets there, okay, because they're coming to take Titus's place in the letter, as soon as either Artemas or Tychicus show up, Titus is supposed to make for a place called Nicopolis. It's in western Greece. And he's supposed to meet Paul there, and they're going to spend the winter together. That's where Paul had decided to spend the winter. The winter, well, it was impossible to travel in those days, and so you had to pick a spot. So Paul wanted him to get there so he could spend the winter with Titus, kind of debriefing maybe, and making plans for what they're going to keep keep on doing. Paul doesn't mess around. Then he mentions Zenas and Apollos. Zenas, we don't know much about except that he was a lawyer. Apollos, you know well. Apollos is a great story. Apollos was a young believer who didn't know a lot, and so the early Christian church power couple of Priscilla and Aquila. Priscilla and Aquila kind of took him under their wing and trained this guy. They discipled him, and he became a great help to the church in Corinth. Even to the point where he's like almost idolized by the church in Corinth. They began following Apollos as opposed to following Christ. But he was a good, solid guy. He was going to be, he and Zenas were going to be there on Crete before going somewhere else, and Titus was supposed to make sure they were equipped and ready to go. It's important to note that it was that kind of hospitality in the early church that led to the spread of the gospel being so quick and effective. Because anywhere an emissary from the church came, the church in that area would clothe them and house them and feed them and equip them and send them off to where they were going next. And then Paul gives us his final greetings. He's to Titus, and everybody who was with Titus, with Paul, sent greetings to Titus. They don't mention any names, but Titus knew who they were probably. He knew who was with Paul, and so he enjoyed that. Oh, yeah, good to hear from him. And then I love how he ends it. I love this benediction. I may use this as our benediction today. Grace be with you all. That's how Paul ended his letter to Titus. Grace be with you all. And what a sufficient summary of the letter, and what a sufficient summary of blessing for us as individuals in Christ. Do we need anything else than grace? We don't, do we? And so if we said to each other, instead of goodbye, we just said, grace be with you, that would be an awesome way to end conversations and times with each other. We need to be careful to maintain good works. We need to be careful about keeping the main thing, because that's the main thing. The main thing for Christians is to keep the main thing. And the main thing is contained in those top 10. Don't waste your time too much arguing about the things that don't have eternal significance. Well, that's how Paul's letter to Titus ends. And next week, like I said, we're going to work our way through a recap of the high points of this letter as a reminder for some key points of application and takeaways from this letter to the church. So let me say, grace be with you all. Amen. Let's pray.